Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. We're continuing special coverage on Thursday's Franken resignation and what follows. Later today at 1 p.m. Central, you'll hear a special episode of Flyover, our national call-in show about American identity. What does this Me Too movement tell us about who we are? That's at 1 p.m. on Flyover. This hour, I'm picking up on something that was raised by a listener yesterday, and I think this deserves more discussion. She believes that Franken's departure is about being both a scapegoat and a political sacrifice. And if you listen closely, you might hear some of that in what Franken said in his resignation speech, as he referred to what some of his complainants said about the humiliation they felt. He added this:
"I was shocked. I was upset. But in responding to their claims, I also wanted to be respectful of that broader conversation, because all women deserve to be heard and their experiences taken seriously. I think that was the right thing to do. I also think it gave some people the false impression that I was admitting to doing things that, in fact, I haven't done. Some of the allegations against me are simply not true. Others I remember very differently."
That is Minnesota Senator Al Franken on the floor of the U.S. Senate yesterday. As our guests join us, I'd like to hear your view, too. If you believe that widespread cultural change is needed on sexual harassment, is the Franken resignation, the Conyers retirement, and any that follow necessary to move forward? How will you know this is beyond just a political moment and it's truly a movement? I mean, does that look like more women running for office, less tolerance of harassment? So I'd like to know how you view what's going on with Senator Franken and some of the other resignations and retirements as necessary to move forward on sexual harassment. And I'd like you to examine how you will know that this is more than a moment, as we talked about yesterday, looking more like a movement. Is it about electing more women? Is it about less tolerance for sexual harassment? Maybe you have a different standard. You can talk to me about that as well. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guest for the discussion, Kelly Dittmar, is with us. She's assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University and joining us today from Philly. And Kelly, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Julian Zelzer is with us. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton, and he's with us today from New York City. And Julian, welcome. Long time no chat. Really good to have you back on the show.
Nice to be back.
Julian, I think this is an interesting observation that came from a listener, and I think she was essentially saying, given the allegations against people like President Trump and Roy Moore, that for this kind of change to happen, there's going to have to be sacrifices and there will have to be political calculations. And in some ways, that's also what Franken's resignation means. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I think there's many who agree that's what's going on. This is, in part, the Democrats trying to position themselves as the party that's on the right side of this issue, taking a very tough stand in pressuring Senator Franken to do this. In part, not just because of Senator Franken or not just because they were convinced about all the allegations, but because they feel politically this will be important if they're really going to tackle the issues that are in front of the nation with the allegations against President Trump, with the Roy Moore situation, or more broadly in dealing with sexual harassment through policy and through legislative change. But many people will question this, they are today, whether this was the right way to do it.
Kelly, that I think is the conundrum that many of our listeners find themselves in, some of whom are supporters of Senator Franken's and some of whom are not. They ask, is this what it will take and is taking to move, to make some progress on sexual harassment? I'd like to know how you see the Franken resignation in the context of that.
Yeah, and I think it's important to put it in context that this is a moment of reckoning, as many have noted, and that reckoning has to happen across party lines. What have we accepted as normal behavior, or behavior that wasn't worth any sort of punishment before versus now. And I think what you're seeing is a bit of a paradigm shift in which the burden of proof in these situations is at least starting to be placed on the abuser over the abused. We're recognizing patterns of behavior. And so in the case of Senator Franken, when you have 4, 5, 6, 7 accusations, it starts to become a pattern of behavior that then needs to be remedied or dealt with, or there needs to be some form of accountability. And so I think we're seeing a change in what we accept as normal and as okay. And that's important because it's a sign of greater institutional change, and that's the type of change that will be sustainable in the long run.
Kelly, I think what you've said is important here, and we've had some other guests say, when you look at patterns like this, and then you look at the upheaval that is being created here as we, as you say, adjust what we are going to accept as normal, this is going to feel tumultuous. It's going to feel painful for some people. But maybe this is what it takes. And I guess that's what I'm asking, to move the discussion forward. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. You know, we all wake up in the morning thinking, who's next, right? Because this type of behavior has been accepted by so many, again, cross party lines for so long. You know, you talk to women about 10, 20 years ago, or even 5 years ago, who will say, oh, yeah, he commented on my appearance, or he touched me. It was kind of odd, but I let it go because that's just how it is. And that's what life is like, especially in masculine, male-dominated institutions where the power dynamics have for so long been in men's favor. And it just seems normal for them to take advantage of that power. And women at this moment are sort of speaking up and standing up against that. And thankfully, there are men standing up as well and saying this is inappropriate. And so it is going to be uncomfortable because so much of this behavior has been accepted for so long. And now women are looking back and saying, oh, that really wasn't appropriate. And actually, I should speak out against the sorts of abuses that I felt in my life, even if at the time I didn't feel I either had the power to speak up or the support or that people would believe me.
Gay says on Twitter, this is not a movement until women and men start speaking out when these things happen and differences between the experiences of men and women are interrogated. And then she adds, Franken was a scapegoat, which leads us nowhere. A call here from Holly in Plymouth. How are you thinking about this, Holly?
You know, I find it really upsetting. I feel like he was drummed out without due process, and I don't think that helps our cause. It can't just be that you can accuse someone and there's no investigation, no disclosure. If those mechanisms to investigate, to provide due process, if they aren't working, we need to fix that rather than having some sort of, I don't know, witch hunt against him. And it's very upsetting to me to have to be on the side of the, on the other side saying, hey, hold on, let's not take these women seriously. I feel like we've gone too far.
Yeah, Holly, I hear you on that when you say it's upsetting to be where you are. Julian, I'm going to come to you on the due process part of this. You've probably been thinking about this.
Well, yes. And so it's important that this situation is about a sitting member of Congress. So the state has elected him. There's an expectation that he'll fulfill the term. So usually the bar is high to removing someone. That's why that happens so often. And usually now we have a process where the Senate Ethics Committee would investigate and make a recommendation after its investigation, and then the body of the Senate would decide what to do. Obviously, a senator has the ability to resign at any moment. This is what Senator Packwood did in 1995. But what will cause concern is this was incredibly rushed, and some would argue that there was excessive pressure for him to act immediately and act quickly. And again, we have to distinguish from Roy Moore, where the voters are now about to make a choice that will last 6 years, as opposed to the Franken case, where the voters already made the choice. So there wasn't much of a process, and Franken has denied this being true, which is not reason to believe that he was falsely accused.
Right.
But it is important to consider when we use these processes before there's any kind of resignation like this. And let's remember, this will have to be done much more broadly if we're going to take it seriously. There's many sitting members, I'm sure, who will be under the microscope in the coming months.
Kelly, I have to admit to something here. I cringe when I see and hear this language of witch hunt and political lynching, and I'm seeing that a lot on, I mean, you know, Senator Franken initially responded pretty quickly to the Leanne Tweeden stuff and some of the other allegations that followed by saying, I apologize for this. I'm accepting some responsibility. Women need to be heard. That's not a witch hunt. I mean, he was a free man to decide how he was going to respond all the way up through yesterday. And it certainly isn't a political lynching. How do you hear the language around what's being discussed here?
Yeah, I think, look, I think it's difficult. I think Julian's correct in that there is a process in place in Congress in terms of the Senate Ethics Committee to deal with this. The ultimate form of accountability for any member of Congress is re-election or election in the first place in the case of Roy Moore. And it should be a process in which the voters have a say. But we do have a process in place to deal with it if it's too soon before an election or something happens between then, and that's the Ethics Committee process. What you saw yesterday with Senator Franken's resignation, I would agree with you, is not a lynching in the sense that he still chose to resign. And yes, there was excessive pressure. You saw the sort of deluge of Democratic senators coming out and calling for his resignation. But ultimately, it was a choice that he could make. And so we have to distinguish that, as well as, to your point, his initial comments admitting to at least some of this type of behavior.
Right.
And again, it does go back to it is hard to get into a back and forth about who to believe and not to believe. But I can't imagine that the Senate Ethics Committee is going to get much more evidence from these cases, right?
Right.
They're going to hear the
right
stories and have to make a choice about who to believe. And so we're still back in the same situation about, do we believe the 7, 8 and probably more women who come forward, or do we believe the member who's sitting in office who is speaking in front of a jury of his peers and colleagues?
You know, Julian, the other reason that I recoil, especially from that political lynching phrase here, is because that puts us, I'm afraid, right back to where Congress has been for so long, and you recently wrote about this, not believing the women. They've got a policy in Congress which basically the accuser had to go through 30 days. I mean, it's just the most ridiculous, absurd procedure. And I'm afraid if we start to use this kind of language, we're right back where Congress was before all this came out.
No, absolutely. And I do think it's important to remember Senator Franken's resigning on his own. And that is a decision. He could easily have said, I'm not resigning. And he could have stuck to his position and stayed in the job until forced to do something else. But I do think underlying some of the concern, A, is that it's not simply Senator Franken. And a handful of other members right now who are under investigation, or Representative Conyers, who's resigning, but that the Congress looks much more broadly at this problem and others who have been problematic, including the President of the United States. And the second is that Congress ultimately deals with the policies in the institution that allow this to happen frequently.
Right.
And each office has total control over its own employment. There is no real human resources process in Congress. And Congress ultimately is not subject to external regulation. And Congress argues that would be a violation of the separation of powers. Others disagree. But you have a system where Franken can resign, some others could resign or be expelled. 5, 10 years from now, we'll be in the exact same place, even if the culture changes, because there are no strong employment policies like we have in some other institutions. So I think Congress really needs to tackle this. This is the moment if we're going to move forward and have a different kind of institution.
I want to recommend your piece that came out recently where you said Congress had ample opportunity to tackle this, and you said they blew it.
Yeah, I wrote about the 1990s after Anita Hill and the confirmation of Clarence Thomas. There was a lot of upset about how the senators handled the issue of sexual harassment.
It was terrible. Terrible.
1992 was the year of the woman. A large number of female senators were elected. There was all kinds of excitement that something would happen. Republicans even take up the issue in 1995 because they're facing Senator Bob Packwood's scandal. And in the end, the reforms are what we have today. They're pretty toothless. They're an improvement, but they certainly don't get at the underlying problem. So all of this happened in the 1990s, and we were left with really half-hearted reforms.
Yeah, Kelly, I'm coming back to the Year of the Woman with you because I want to talk about your newest research on how what may change here. But let me grab another call from Steve in Superior, Wisconsin. Hi, Steve.
Good morning. I just want to reiterate something that one of your guests said, that employment policy in every job I've ever had would have allowed for some kind of mediation and investigation and something resembling due process. And I think that's obviously why a lot of people are upset about Al Franken's resignation. One thing that hasn't been talked a lot about is the fact that settlements and non-disclosure agreements, but the settlement money is coming out of taxpayer money, both at the congressional level and at the business deduction in the private sector. Mm. If that was remedied via federal legislation, that would go a long way toward disincentivizing sexual harassment in both Congress and in every workplace across America.
Yeah. So, Steve, are you saying if they couldn't keep them hidden, or you're saying what?
Well, that first of all, no business should be able to deduct settlement out of their taxes.
So you think a tax
that
deduction
be
would
out of a CEO's pay, or that should not be a tax deductible business expense?
Okay, all right. I appreciate the call to Bill in St. Paul. Hi, Bill. How are you thinking about this?
Hey, good morning. My thought is that in the political world, there hasn't been a sea change on this topic. That it's all political reaction, that it was safe for the Democrats to turn on Al Franken because Minnesota has a Republican governor, or I'm sorry, a Democratic governor that will choose a Democratic replacement. With President Trump and Roy Moore, the charges came up in an election setting where the only alternative is the other party. So people aren't thinking about sexual harassment or the charges so much as not letting the other party win. And I think that there is change going on in journalism, in the entertainment world, in the business world, but in the political world, I think it is just political reaction and posturing that we are seeing.
Yeah, and political calculation, which I think we talked about at the beginning of the conversation. If you've just tuned in, it's a discussion. It's more of our coverage on Senator Al Franken's decision to resign from the floor of the Senate yesterday. And I'm asking something that was raised in a tweet by a listener yesterday and then building on that. She was saying that she thought that he was a scapegoat, but also a necessary sacrifice. And I think you could hear a little bit of that and what Senator Franken said from the floor of the Senate. So I'm asking you to weigh in if you believe widespread cultural change is needed on this issue. And I'm hearing from a lot of you who say yes. Is the Franken resignation, the Conyers retirement, the reckoning that we're talking about here, is this what's necessary to move forward? And how will you know that we are moving past the moment and that we're in a movement where serious change happens? Is that about more women running for office? Is it less tolerance everywhere in all those industries that our caller just talked about, less tolerance of harassment? 800-242-2828, 651-227, 6000, and on Twitter at @CarrieNPR. Jordan is tweeting saying about Franken, he's not being tried in a court of law and was also not expelled. Resignation was his choice. Leanne Tweeden shared photo evidence of her being harassed by Al Franken. I don't see what else NPR News listeners need. All harassment is unacceptable. Kelly, let me come back to you on how we'll know that this is real change. Because as Julian points out, Year of the Woman, 1992, yes, women made gains electorally, but it also seems like women hit a ceiling pretty quickly, too, as far as elective office. Tell me what you think about that and what you're seeing now.
Sure, yeah. So in 1992, we saw basically a nearly doubling of the number of women in Congress, and there were a number of factors for that. Among them was the Clarence Thomas hearings, and seeing the women across the country saw very starkly the underrepresentation of women and minorities in the U.S. Senate and in Congress more generally, because they could see the all-white male panel questioning Anita Hill and doing so in a quite aggressive and derogatory manner. And so it was not only that they couldn't see the lack of women there, but they understood the importance of having women who would better understand her experiences and be sensitive to them and understand what sexual harassment not only is, but what it feels like. And there were no women in that room in that hearing to be able to do it. And it motivated a number of women to consider running, to put their names on the ballot. But I should say that that's not the only reason that we saw a jump of women in office that year. It was also, if you remember, there was the franking scandal. So people were losing seats or not running again. And then it was a post-redistricting year. So we saw a lot of open seats.
I want to make sure everybody heard you say franking. That was that was using taxpayer money for, I think, campaign activity, if I remember right.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. For mail. And so those things set up a situation in which you had a number of open seats that these women who were energized could then run for and win because they were competitive. Up until probably this week, I would have told you that the difference in 2018 is that, yes, we have a lot of the same energy. Yes, our recent report shows that at this point in the election compared to previous cycles, we've almost doubled the number of women running for office in 2018, particularly for the U.S. House. That's huge. But I would have put caution on that because many of those women are challengers. They're challenging incumbent candidates. This is not a year where there's a ton of open seats. This dynamic in which we're seeing members resign, we're seeing members pushed out of office, means that there's going to be more open seats. And there are women ready and women who've already put their name forward to run for many of these. So this changes the dynamic in a number of ways because not only is the energy already there among women, they will be able to now seek out some of these open seats. And importantly, the saliency of this topic, I think, demonstrates the asset of being a woman in this election cycle, because they can come into the cycle saying, I know how to handle this issue. And quite frankly, women have not been the problem when it comes to sexual harassment and sexual assault.
So, Julian, take Kelly's explanation of their research and tell me what you think as a historian and public affairs professor.
I mean, my sense is it is different than 1992 and that period. I just think that election in itself and that whole decade has already changed some of the conditions. So we're not simply replicating that moment, and there's been gains numerically and been gains in terms of attitude and policy. So it could very well be different. I think the point on the many of them being challengers is important to remember. It's not clear how unstable incumbents are going to be in the midterm elections. So all of that is worth remembering. And I'd add one more thing. There's another question. Everyone is talking about the sacrifice that Democrats might have just made. It's not clear where this is going to go and whether the other party is willing to do anything like this. And so I think one of the fears running through the Democratic Party is that they will take many steps and it will be asymmetrical.
Yes.
And the Republicans won't do the same.
That's a really good way to put it, Julian. And I've been hearing from so many people, including many people on Twitter this morning, saying, well, when we've got Trump in office with what he did and we've got Roy Moore poised, it looks like, to win this seat in Alabama, why should the Democrats disarm? But there's a good response, I guess, to that, which I think is persuasive to some, which is moral authority is moral authority, whether it involves some kind of political sacrifice or not. Well, what would you say?
Well, I mean, look, yes, it is important to have moral authority as a party, and it's certainly important for the long-term character of the party, but it certainly doesn't ensure anything in the short term.
That's
and
right.
Democrats should realize they are losing a major player in the party, someone who's even been, you know, a possible Democratic candidate. And in the short term, it might the moral superiority might not help. And there, some Republicans run with a very different calculus, including the president. That's just not a concern for him. And he has the White House. So that should be clear to Democrats. This might be more of a sacrifice politically than they're expecting. That doesn't mean it's wrong. It might be the absolute right thing to do. But it's not clear this will give them any kind of political benefit right now.
Jamal says
Carrie,
on... Kelly, go right ahead. Now, go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to jump on that because in line with what a previous caller talked about this, you know, in terms of political calculation, and I think maligning this as total political calculation is a little bit wrongheaded, at least in one way. We know that if you continue to allow folks in your party to behave in this way, you lose credibility on some really important policy issues. So to the extent that this is a political calculation, I think it's a calculation to be sure that somebody like Kirsten Gillibrand, who came out openly on this, can continue to put forward legislation about sexual assault and violence against women without being deemed a hypocrite. And so there is a political calculation in that, but I think it's a fair and it's a smart one, because if you want to move policy forward that's going to empower women, not only in the U.S. Senate or in the Congress, but across the country, you need to have that moral authority, that credibility, that when it happens to somebody in your family, in your party, you're also going to stand up to it. And so you're able to put forth and have the political capital to put forth those sorts of policy issues.
Jamal says on Twitter, kind of responding to what Julian and Kelly have just said, these talks on the usefulness of Franken are pointless. He did it. He admitted it. Services are no longer needed in the Senate. Listening to DFLers make excuses is the straw. I'm leaving. What happened to believe women? Our conversation here, if you've just gotten in on it, is about, of course, some of the political fallout from Senator Franken's decision yesterday, but also putting a lens to that and saying, for as tumultuous and difficult as this is for many supporters of Senator Franken, is this what it is taking to move forward on sexual harassment? And back to the phones to Peg, listening in Mound, Minnesota. Peg, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi.
What are you thinking about?
We don't have human resources.
Peg, I'm going to ask you to speak into the phone. Otherwise, we can't hear you.
Okay. We don't have a human resources department for elected officials, but that's what the parties are for. We have, and that's what the caucus convention system is for. There is a nominations committee. There are screening committees. And I've sat on a number of screening committees over the years. And never once has it occurred to me to ask someone if they have ever sexually harassed or assaulted a woman.
Yeah. Well,
and that's going to have to change. But that's easy enough to do. And that's one of the values of having the caucus convention system, because we can ask them before they get to the point.
Better screening. Peg, I appreciate the question because this came up yesterday in our conversation. Kelly, one of our guests said, We really need to broaden the scope of what we're interrogating here as we're deciding who's going to represent the parties in Congress and statewide office. I'm not sure potential candidates would come clean on some of this.
Yeah, I think this is a really tough measure, right? But I do think it is about raising the standards of behavior, so an expectation for what candidates have done, because I think there are probably cases in which there were rumors or we knew, oh, that guy is, you know, I've heard a little bit about him,
oh,
but
yeah.
You, again, choose not to believe it because he's a good political candidate. He's been good to the party. He's going to raise a lot of money. And we've overlooked that stuff. Again, like Democrats, Republicans, it's happened on all sides of the aisle. And I think you're at a moment where in those conversations now, somebody needs to stand up and say, oh, no, we can't overlook that. It's not only going to come back and bite us politically, but it's also not okay. And we need to raise the bar.
Here's Derek on Twitter who says, I'm glad Franken resigned. He's not a scapegoat or a sacrifice. He's owning up. His resignation is the turning point on sexual harassment in politics. Before now, when the man was powerful enough, the women lost. And he says, example, Paula Jones and Anita Hill. That's changing now. And then he gets a reply from Dr. Rin Porter on Twitter who says, well, Derek, you make a good point. But I still feel that the Democrats railroaded Franken. There must be some other way of punishing a person besides forcing him or her to resign. There are various types of sentences in our criminal codes now, not just hanging everyone. Julian, tell me what you hear in that exchange.
Well, first, you know, I think many people hope this is a turning point, and many people hope that Franken taking this step becomes an important moment in changing the institution, changing the expectations, and ending this very large, serious problem of sexual harassment by members of Congress. It's not clear it will be a turning point, and it's not clear that his resignation will fundamentally change the dynamics in Washington. And many people, again, are looking at the election, potential election of Roy Moore, who's been accused of really horrendous acts toward underaged women, and the polls are showing he might win. And so this might have been the sacrifice of a career. It might help the Democrats have better standing to deal with this, but it might not change the politics as much as some are hoping for. And there are other ways Congress could have done something if he had stayed in. They could have censured him, which is a majority of the Senate could have basically given him a verbal reprimand, or two-thirds of the Senate could have expelled him if they wanted. But obviously we're not going to reach that point. Again, though, this was Senator Franken's decision. He wasn't forced to resign. He resigned. He was under pressure, and he made a decision. So I think the real question is this a turning point moment, or is this just the case of Franken and things don't really change as much as some are hoping?
You know, the other thing, Kelly, I take Senator Franken at his word, because there was language in that resignation speech about how can I be the most effective senator I can be on behalf of the people of Minnesota when this investigation is going on. And I don't know, he didn't add this, but potentially when there may be more people coming forward. I'm going to accept that he really means that this is such a huge distraction. He couldn't do the work he wanted to do.
Yeah, and I think we've seen that before. This is not the first time that somebody's been pushed to this point.
That's right.
In Congress. And I do think that there's a point of sacrifice on Senator Franken's part to say, in order to best represent the people of Minnesota, we need somebody who is not going to be embroiled in this type of scandal and can actually focus on the work of representing Minnesotans. And that in and of itself is a motivation for him to step aside. And I think that's what you actually heard from a number of the Democratic senators who said, look, he's a colleague, he's a friend, but we also need to continue the work of this Congress. And his presence is not only a distraction from that, but also undermines some of the policy objectives that we find most important, because it does seem hypocritical if he doesn't step down. So I think you saw that line of reasoning, not just from Senator Franken, but from other senators.
That's true. Dominic on Twitter, Franken could have been the thoughtful and articulate vehicle by which we could have interrogated gender inequality. Instead, we just threw him under the bus and drove on. And then another listener here on Twitter says he wasn't forced. He gave up his privilege because he recognized he no longer earned it. Julian Kelly, you getting a sense of how how divided and ambivalent Minnesotans are about this? Whoa.
I think that is part of what makes this extraordinarily difficult for many Democrats. It's not simply that they liked him or that he was good for the state. He actually was championing real legislation on issues like violence, domestic violence, that are exactly what's needed. So they're losing a key voice on the very issues that are at the heart of this. And that makes the sacrifice different than some other members. And there you're genuinely sacrificing a vote for all the legislation that's going to be on the table in the next year if Congress is serious about this.
That's a really good point. I also think you're touching on the dissonance, Julian, of this too. And that's been, I think, difficult to accept for many women. Such a strong voice on issues that matter to many women. And yet the dissonance of, you know, seven or eight people coming out to say, and some photographic evidence too, he did this. That's hard to square too. I hear
right.
people
and
on
so
that.
The cynic will say, you know, the dissonance is harder for Democrats than for Republicans.
Yes.
So right now, Roy Moore will be elected because of evangelical voters coming out to vote for him. But Democrats can't live with that kind of dissonance. But I think that's exactly what makes this also very difficult. It's just a total disconnect between what he stood for and the way he apparently acted.
I've got a caller who wants to hang on. Kelly, I'm just going to grab this call, but I do want to hear you speak to this. But I think Ann in Roseville is asking about this, too. Hi, Ann.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Yes, as a mom and as a mother of a young daughter, I just struggle with this whole Me Too moment right now and Franken going. And I just wonder if you can explain to me, and I've talked to Witherman on the other side, the hypocrisy of the Me Too movement. It's where, you know, the Democrats can checkmark, we won the moral battle. You know, we think we are the decent people, you know, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, how does that, you know, with women coming in, possibly into the Senate and to the House with these open elections, if the other side can sort of, you know, pass over everything, like with Roy Moore's history and for the current president's history, and that's allowed and that's acceptable. And I'm really struggling with this being a true turning point if we have people who can just say, that doesn't really matter. How do I explain it to myself? How do I explain it to my daughter? I'm struggling with that as someone who's very active in politics and really feels like this is, we all need to be involved in it.
It's a good policies. Question. Kelly, I'll throw that hot potato on you. What do you think?
Sure. I mean, look, I think what the Democrats are trying to sort of assure that they represented, and in the case of the commentary around this moment, it is a question about politics and political motivations versus value and principle. And so there are Republicans who have stood up and said, you know, there's a line in the sand here and we don't support this type of behavior. We don't think Roy Moore should be elected. Unfortunately, that's not what the leadership and the sort of majority, particularly at the president and the RNC, have sort of set that aside because they're more concerned about the political outcome of this election. And so in my explanation, if I were explaining to folks what this represents, is the real political divisiveness in this country, the party polarization, and how that then affects our willingness to really focus on this issue as a nonpartisan issue over principles and power. And in this case, in particular, power between men and women, and how we need to really grapple with that. And, you know, to the point before I was going to make, Carrie, was about this idea of the lesson that we're seeing in this moment of seeing that you can have men who are working on these issues, as Senator Franken did, and rightfully should be praised for, but they can also be men who engaged in bad behavior or abused their power in ways that made women vulnerable or victimized women.
Right.
That can both happen.
Right.
And we need to all understand that because there are men in our lives and in other institutions who have done the same thing. And so we have to recognize that men, just as women, are nuanced in their behavior and their perspectives. And often it's about situations of power and what is they deem as humor and we deem as victimization. These are the conversations we have to go forward. And I think actually the Senator Franken's case gives us a really
tough case, but an interesting case to grapple with questions like that.
That's such a great point. Julian, that comes up with Representative Conyers, too. Deep work on civil rights for listeners who aren't familiar with his background. There's the dissonance again. All this work on civil rights, a reliable vote on legislation that matters to women, and then payoffs to women for sexual harassment.
Absolutely. And this is not the first time we've seen this. And I keep referring to Senator Bob Packwood, who had his own investigation, resigned.
Bill Clinton, too, right?
Right, and he was a champion of women's issues. I think, though, the other context that unsettles some people is right now the Republicans control Congress. You have a pretty conservative president, and they are moving to systematically dismantle a lot of the protections that do exist already. And so every vote that the Democrats can muster really counts. Mm-hmm. And I think there's an assumption that a Democrat will eventually win this seat, but that's not 100% clear. It could
that's
be more
right.
competitive. And so then there is a there could really be a policy cost. And so I think that's the other moral question here, which is not irrelevant in terms of being careful at this moment in terms of who gets lost in what's really a political war taking place in Washington. But
that's right.
There'll be many Democrats. I don't know how they'll feel in 2019 if this seat goes red and the Republicans on the Hill have one more vote to push through a pretty conservative agenda.
Oh, there will be finger pointing.
Kinds of issues.
This is how we've gotten here, right? So we've gotten here by allowing this type of behavior because the political calculation was that we needed a member in office or they would raise more money. So I think, you know, there's a risk, but there's also a risk on the sort of morality and principle side and honestly on the safety of women to not address these sorts of issues.
You know, Kelly, the other thing I was thinking about when we were talking about the dissonance of somebody who supports legislation or is a champion for women and then has this in their background, you know, this happens in business all the time. I mean, women mentored by, you know, a leader in a company and also having to fend off advances or knowing friends in the company that have to fend off the advances. This is not unusual.
No. And it gets to how we define harassment, how we understand power dynamics. So you'll hear men, and we have in the last couple of weeks, repeatedly say things like, well, and Senator Franken said this, I saw that situation very differently. And I believe him. I believe that he saw that situation very differently.
Uh-huh.
So part of this moment is an education to, in many cases, to men about what it feels like to be on the other side of some of those advances, when the power dynamic is unequal, when you think it's a joke, but in fact, it actually feels threatening to women. These are the conversations we need to have with our friends, because I don't think in many cases it's intentional or malicious. But they don't understand how it may feel for women in these situations when you're not this sort of empowered party. And that's a really important conversation for us all to have. I should say it also speaks to the importance of having women in all of these conversations. So we advocate for more women in office. I think this moment we'll see women talk about the importance of having women in office. And we saw the role of women in the Senate really taking a lead on saying, we have to draw the line, a line in the sand at some point to say that this is unacceptable. And Senator Kirsten Gillibrand had done an interview with us. We did some research on women's representation last year. And one of the lines she said is, look, I think it's easier for a female member to imagine what it's like to be victimized, to be disbelieved, to be disregarded and retaliated against.
Oh, yeah.
It's something they can imagine because it's something they've experienced.
Kelly, really good to have you. Thanks. Kelly Dittmar with us from Rutgers University, Camden. And Julian, thank you so much. Good to chat again. And Julian Zelzer with us from Princeton University. I want to grab one last call here from Carrie and Egan. I'm a little tight on time, Carrie, but wanted to hear what you're thinking about.
So my concern with all of this has been that in focusing on individuals, on channeling all our energy into Republican versus Democrat, Franken versus Moore, what we're not doing is having the bigger conversation as a society about how we are as a culture creating men who then think they can do this. I was at a volleyball game this fall in South Metro here. And when the opposing team was serving, when the girl was serving the ball, there were boys in the stands who would yell to fluster her. They would yell, "Nice, you know, backside," only using a different word, and no repercussions. And I'm sitting there thinking, in this whole Me Too time, what is being done to correct these boys? And not, I mean, how are we going to avoid creating another generation of boys who grow into men who assume positions of power and then abuse it, which is what the theme is here. It's men in positions of power. And I just don't see us doing much to accept responsibility as a culture versus pointing fingers and saying, oh, it's him, it's these guys, when I kind of think it's probably all of us to some extent contributing to this.
Yeah, Carrie, you're actually looking ahead to, we're going to have a discussion on Monday about how younger women, and I mean college-age women, millennial women, are hearing this conversation. And then I think there's another opportunity to talk about how you discuss this with your kids, how you raise young boys to respect the kinds of things and be aware of the kinds of things that Carrie was talking about. So more discussion to come on these issues around sexual harassment. I've been getting a lot of mail from you, and I've just taken a little bit of it. So I'm getting it via email and, of course, on Twitter. And I like to ask digital producer Nancy Yang to come in and read some mail with me. So, Nancy, thank you for doing this.
Hello.
I heard from Denise, who said on sexual harassment and Al Franken, "I hope everyone is happy that a good man went down today. I hope you all feel alleged Randy touching warrants an entire career to go down in flames. I just hope you all feel vindicated that this is right and just." From you?
Yeah, Peter wrote to you and he said, you know, why not let the ethics committee give it, why not give them a chance to do their job? You know, I think the people who voted for him and him and he also deserve due process. This isn't justice, but this is not justice, but a political lynching, he says.
Ray says, "I won't be disrespectful as some of the others who have emailed you have been." I was talking about this last week. "I have to say I'm a fan of NPR. I listen daily, contribute during each member drive. I don't feel you or the station have been fair in your coverage of Al Franken. As journalists, I feel it's important that your personal feelings and beliefs don't override your objectivity. But as you speak on this particular subject, I don't think you've been objective."
Nancy writes in, "If we take this punishment of Franken as the model for how do we respond to men who admit and apologize and take responsibility for their mistaken behavior, we have little hope of moving forward in a progressive and equitable manner. We should slow down, hear all sides, and get a thorough understanding of the situation."
Shoto wrote to say that she is concerned about the political calculation going on here by Democrats and what that means for Senator Franken's career. And then she says, "I have an idea in this Me Too moment. South Africa dealt with offenses of racism by the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions. Stories were told, victims confronted accusers, and accusers were either forgiven or punished, depending on a lot of factors. That process was a way of deep healing from outrage. We should do it. Of course, we have a federal administration that absolutely wants to keep in power. But I would like people to start talking about it to get it out of the political arena." And Nancy, I think that's what Carrie, our last caller, was also speaking to as well, that the politics is one place that we hope there will be some progress on this, but it is, seems to be institutional. And how do we bring this deeper into the places we work and the families we raise? So more discussion for me on that.
Yeah, you know, Patrick, kind of touching on that, you know, another caller was talking about some of the backlash, but Patrick was saying that, you know, he thinks some of the backlash is from men is that most men are not abusers and that they don't understand what women go through. But he says, you know, we need these stories so that we can talk about it within our families and have these frank discussions with women who have suffered in our lives to start understanding the insanity that women are subjected to and to recognize the magnitude of the transgressions.
Seema wrote in to say, "Franken is a scapegoat. I'm deeply disappointed at all the women in the Senate and Congress who are rushing to take a stand against him, while none of them have done so against the real predator. This is hypocrisy. The movement started decades ago, and we'll keep moving forward." Nancy, thank you for this. 1 o'clock, Flyover. It's our national call-in show on American identity, and we're talking today about gender and politics and power and identity. Phone lines will be open. That's 1 o'clock Central, National Call-In Show. Join us.